Can't wait to see So I think we're going to ask, because we have a couple of nominations for president to add resolution eight, appendix E update. And we can strike, what do I call it? Item number six, because there are no meeting minutes for that meeting, because there was not one.
I don't know if you need a second.
But oh, yeah. Motion to strike. Sorry.
Second.
All right. I think all of those are added in. Should be good. We'll move on to approving the previous meeting minutes. In the back of the agenda, we have the February 5th meeting minutes. If you could quickly look over those. And we're also going to pull up on Zoom the March 25th meeting minutes. They're uploaded into the box. And in a minute or two, I would, if there aren't any changes, look kindly upon a motion to approve both by unanimous.
To approve the minutes.
Do we need to pull up the other ones to look at the
screen? It's all weird. I'm sorry.
Point of inquiry. I can't seem to find the previous minutes. I only see the February one on the box.
The other one is March, not April-y. That helps.
Yeah, that actually helps. Never mind. Thank you.
April 8th is the one, the first striking, the teaser was not wrong.
Mm-hmm. Just slowly roll through that.
Check yeah. Button. I should have pulled it up on the other screen.
No, that wasn't even there.
This was the one I tried.
Oh, yeah. Good memories. Well, I'd like to second the motion that was made by I forgot who gave this by us to approve the meeting minutes.
All right. Are there any objections to approving those two meeting minutes? Fantastic. All right. We will briefly, we'll actually go right now into our presentation from Bob Weiss from the Graduate School. Ooh.
Hey, thanks, Malia. It's a real pleasure to be here and to meet with you all. I'm going to walk through a couple of things. I'll start by just telling you a little bit about myself and my background, and I'll talk about my previous administrative role at Cornell, which included oversight over a graduate program at the College of Veterinary Medicine while I was Associate Dean for Research and Graduate Education. And then I'll talk about a couple of large initiatives that are my responsibility as now a senior associate dean at the Graduate School. Okay, so by way of background, just to tell you a little bit about myself, I grew up in Northern Indiana. I was an undergraduate at a small liberal arts college, an all-male school called Wabash College, where I majored in biology. From there, I got a PhD from Baylor College of Medicine in molecular virology, the study of viruses, and I studied a virus that caused cancer, and that got me very interested in the origins of cancer, and so now I'm a full-fledged cancer biologist. My training continued at Harvard Medical School, where I was a postdoctoral fellow, and then I went from Harvard to Cornell. So I joined the Cornell faculty in 2002 and have really enjoyed my time here as a really collegial and collaborative institution. And I kind of try and balance my efforts between maintaining a research lab, which I'll tell you about very briefly, and then administrative responsibilities at the university. I think in terms of talking about myself, I want to tell you a little bit about myself personally. So here's a picture of my family. Some might recognize Sylvia Lee, who I'm married to, and she's a faculty member in the Department of Molecular Biology and Genetics. We have two daughters. In the middle is our younger daughter, Skyla, who was born here in Ithaca. And then our older daughter in the light blue jacket is Chen, grew up in China and joined our family about 5 years ago. A couple of vets. This is kind of an obligatory obligatory slide for a vet college faculty member showing your pets. So we have a dog we adopted during the pandemic, Sadie, and a couple of cats, Mama and Baby. And I'm a real strong proponent of life-work balance, and I think it's really important for graduate students, faculty, everybody here at the university. My outlet is kind of outdoor activities and do a little running and swimming. And I used to be more of a triathlete. This is kind of the way triathlon snapshot there. In terms of my research group, so my appointment at Cornell is 50% as a faculty member, primarily leading a research group and doing some teaching, and then 50% as an administrator. My research lab is here. I wanted to note my lab, which is not unusual in the life sciences and the biomedical sciences in particular, has graduate students from many graduate fields. And so I recruit students primarily from the three graduate fields that are listed here. So currently I have 5 PhD students in my lab, and they come from biochemistry, molecular and cell biology, genetics, genomics and development, and biomedical and biological sciences. The BBS program is administered in the College of Veterinary Medicine. EMCB and GGD are administered in the Department of Molecular Biology and Genetics. And we do fundamental cancer research, study fundamental mechanisms in the origins and therapeutic responses of cancers. And we do some other aspects of normal development and disease. And we're funded by the NIH and some other funding sources. Okay, so I mentioned I previously was Associate Dean for Research and Graduate Education at the College of Veterinary Medicine, and one responsibility of that role is oversight over the BBS PhD program, and this is just a quick snapshot. This program has 5 different concentration areas, and it has students in 3 different tracks, basically students coming in out of undergraduate or master's degree program pursuing a PhD. There are veterinarians that pursue PhD through the BBS program, and then they're finally combined DVM PhD students who are doing both DVM and PhD training simultaneously. And I borrowed this slide from a kind of wrap-up presentation I gave as I was completing my term as associate dean. This was at the end of last year, and I just highlighted a couple of key things that were important developments during my tenure as associate dean. I don't take full responsibility for these things. There were many people that contributed to these, many faculty in the BBS program, our director of graduate studies, Dave Lynn. So this was really a group and team effort that, but I think led to some really important advances. And I think some of these are themes that are kind of very broadly relevant in graduate education. I think some of the things I'll talk about are particular to life sciences and maybe even biomedical sciences. I think some aspects of this, however, are broadly applicable to graduate education. I think one thing was an emphasis on a skills-based curriculum. So rather than really focusing on really detailed coursework in very specific disciplinary areas, the BBS program really emphasized a skills-based curriculum, which I think is really important for graduate education. Skills that all graduate students need, things like communication skills in this area, quantitative skills training, grant writing skills, critical thinking skills, these things that are fundamental to any scientists working in this area. And I think then that leaves kind of the more narrow disciplinary training to either a small number of classes or even other types of approaches like journal clubs or lab-based training activities. While I was associate dean, the program also made big strides in diversity, equity, inclusion. This is in part including greater amounts of diversity within the student population, but also having these issues on the forefront of discussions between students and faculty, and providing mechanisms for people to discuss these issues. Career development training is another area that I think is really important for how we think about graduate education, training graduate students for success in the future in careers. And those can be many different careers, not just the traditional academic careers that used to be the outcome for almost all PhD students, but you know, diversity of careers where trainees can use their degrees to be successful in a career. Life skills and wellness as well, providing you know opportunities, for instance, financial management skills, which are really important for graduate students, not always things that people are familiar with. And this can be, these are helpful skills for graduate students and providing some opportunities for training in those areas. Mentor training, and I'll point really to the graduate school for developing these training sessions for faculty. And this is a quite recent development, and I think probably you're all well aware, as scientists, when we are trained and in preparation for an academic career, mentor training traditionally and historically has not been a part of what we learn about. And so I think this is a really important advance to help prepare faculty to be more effective mentors. And then finally, I listed student scholarly achievement. This is really the success of the students that I was highlighting in this particular presentation. I think part of it from the field perspective is how can we position students to be successful? And for instance, in the program, we developed a grant writing course that helped students be successful with NSF and NIH pre-doctoral fellowship applications. Okay, and then just one other quick thing I wanted to note was as I was leaving the role, one transition we made related to the governance structure for the graduate field. So you're familiar with the primary role of the Director of Graduate Studies as kind of the administrative lead for the graduate fields. This graduate field was growing to be quite large, about 100 graduate students, and a lot of those responsibilities were falling to a single person. This was a massive job, really too much for any one faculty member to take on. So what we did is kind of restructured the role and went from really one person running the field to a more distributed governance model, which I think has a lot of advantages. It just makes it manageable so that the individuals involved in leading the field from the faculty side have enough time to do all these different things well. And there's also an aspect of continuity built into this. So you have multiple faculty members that have leadership roles in the program. When individuals transition out of roles, you have other people that can step up that are familiar with the way things work and can lead to smooth transition. So we kind of split up the traditional DGS role into three pieces with a named DGS who has a signature authority with the graduate school, primarily responsible for first year advising. And then we had other individuals that led admissions and recruitment, as well as curriculum and programming. And then they're complemented by a executive committee with fields representing those different faculty members representing the different concentration areas within the field. And those faculty would help advising in particular second year and beyond students. And I think we're really happy with the way this new model is working. And I think it's maybe a good model that could be used more broadly for us. Okay, so now I'll just transition to some of the initiatives that I'm trying to lead as a senior associate dean. And these both focus on life sciences graduate education at Cornell in a broad way. And the first of these relates to how we structure our graduate fields. It focuses in these initial steps on the biomedical research graduate fields in particular. So here's a list of life science related graduate fields at Cornell. You can make the list longer if you'd like. There are other fields that have aspects of life sciences that aren't listed here. And I highlighted a few particular ones that have a fairly large biomedical focus. And partly I say biomedical in part because these are programs that are largely funded and the faculty in them are largely funded by the NIH. So biochemistry, molecular and cell biology, biomedical and biological sciences, biophysics, and genetics, genomics, and development. And so one aspect of my role as senior associate dean is to kind of look at these graduate fields, review how they're structured, evaluate it, and think about whether any changes to the way these programs are structured would be advantageous. And this could be little changes to, you know, how do the fields communicate with each other, to bigger changes in terms of how the structure is presented and how they're formally organized. And I just note here what I think are some real advantages that could be the outcome of this kind of process. The first relates to efficiency gains. So if you think about those four graduate fields that I just mentioned, which are closely related, they altogether include nearly 300 graduate students. Many of the faculty that are part of those graduate fields are part of multiple graduate fields. I mentioned how I take through students from three of those different graduate fields, and there's huge overlap in the faculty composition of those graduate fields. So if you think about the way we operate currently, where these are really distinct graduate fields, we can imagine there's some inefficiencies with program administration, administering these different programs separately, faculty governance. I know faculty members that are on the executive committees for three different graduate fields, same faculty member. So doing a lot of double duty or triple duty when maybe isn't necessary. And you can think about how these programs might team up to do things together when they're looking at, for instance, admissions, similar pool of applicants, thinking about curriculum, the courses needed for these programs are largely overlapping, some specialized, but also many overlapping. And then other aspects of programming, some of which they already work together on. So like DEI, for instance, there are DEI programs that bring trainees and faculty together across those graduate fields. And there have also been some really outstanding career development sessions that span fields. I think there are advantages that could be yielded with respect to improving consistency across the student experience, which I think would be a real positive for Cornell and could eliminate, sorry, I can't see it on the end, but eliminate some current irregularities within these programs. So one good example for those graduate fields is that their timing of rotations. So these students, when they apply to Cornell, they come in the first year, they rotate and typically in three different laboratories. The duration and the timing of those rotations, even though they're rotating in many of the same labs, between programs, the timing is not the same. So you can have a student from one program that needs to join a lab by March, and a student in another program that needs to join a lab by the end of April. And you can imagine how that's a challenge both for that student when they're sort of competing for positions between different programs and students are joining labs at different times. And that's also hard for the faculty. They're trying to match with students that are interested in their labs, but they have to make decisions on students at different times. And I think by having these programs communicate and be better aligned, we could get rid of some of those inconsistencies. I think there are great opportunities to strengthen financial support for these programs. And part of the challenge with this relates to these programs span colleges. So they're not embedded within a single department or even a single college. We have students that will come to one program that's administered in one college and then move to another college. And there are some challenges with the financial support for these students. And I just listed out here, and if you guys have ideas on this front, I'd be eager to hear them too, about how we support students financially through these programs. And we use funds from many different sources. Some of the institutional funds like Cornell Fellowships, we use college level support. So the colleges are contributing money, either dollars directly or TA positions to help support students in these programs. There are opportunities to raise money through philanthropy. I'll talk more about external training grants that can be used for these programs. Individual student fellowships. I mentioned before how we try to help prepare students to be competitive with individual fellowships. And then I think one interesting opportunity down the road is looking at biotech and pharmaceutical industry as a mechanism of support. Many of our graduates take this as a career path now. Those companies are really benefiting from the outstanding training we provide at Cornell, and they get that benefit really without contributing much to us. And so I think there are many opportunities potentially to partner with biotech and pharma to support students and really strengthen our programs. I think there are also advantages for student recruitment. I know there are students from these fields here with us today, but when you look from the outside at Cornell, if you're a student, say, interested in molecular genetics related to a disease, and you wonder which program should I apply to, there's really, you know, three different programs that you could easily make a case for, and it can be very confusing for students from the outside to know which of these programs is the right fit for me. And so having this structure that makes that clear would be advantageous. And then I think the final point and the final area I'll talk about is that I think the way we have these programs arranged, we could use it to position ourselves better for training grant success. And I'll explain what I mean by that in the next slide. So one way that many institutions and historically Cornell has supported students financially and also academically in training in biomedical areas is through what are known as NIH T32 training grants. And so basically the NIH, National Institutes of Health, has funding that is designed to support biomedical scientists all throughout their career. And this kind of goes from training on the top to advanced faculty careers on the bottom, starting with pre-bac programs. And then there are programs that support graduate students or postdocs. And then there are some programs that support faculty. And so the career development piece is listed on the right. And then the research grants are listed on the left. And so you can see that NIH really has this strategy to support individuals that want to develop their careers in science and biomedical science from pre-bac stage all the way through to senior faculty stage. And the one that can be advantageous for our training programs are these T32 grants or institutional training grants. And these are grant programs that support a specific research area. So traditionally, for instance, we've had training grants in molecular and cellular biology or genetics or biophysics across many of these different areas. And they're designed really to supplement the training that the institution and the existence of a graduate program at an institution provide additional funding to help, one, enhance the programming that's offered, and then two is to provide support for trainees, so provide stipend and tuition support. So the benefits of these, financial support, they really drive training enhancement in a couple of ways. So NIH will say, these are important factors that we think our training programs need to achieve. And I think one great example of this is diversity, equity, and inclusion. I think NIH was really way ahead of pushing institutions to say you need a diverse group of graduate students. And I think there are many examples of where these programs and also the competition required, you know, the level of competition to get one of these grants really brings out the excellence in graduate training. They're beneficial for student recruitment, and they synergize with other programs on campus like big centers. So, you know, a center in one area can really synergize with a graduate training program or a training grant. And I'll just say that over the years, Cornell has done well in securing training grants, but I'd say in recent years, we have underperformed in this area. We're not getting as many training grants as we should. And there are, you know, a number of reasons for that. I think some relate to changes at the NIH and their selection process and what they're looking for in these training grants. But I think there are things we can do on our end to be more successful with training grants. So that's another of my goals, that is to enhance our outcomes with training grant applications. And I think as we think about what factors into that, I just list, and this is my last slide, a couple of elements that I'm thinking about the way as to how we can better support training grant applications and help our institution be more successful with these. So these are massive applications. Typical training grants, about a 400-page application, hundreds of pages of data that are required about student populations and student outcomes. For the PIs, the individuals that are PIs on these grants, it's kind of a selfless task. It's not like you're writing a research grant where you know if this is successful, all that money's coming to my lab and I can use this to do the research I want to do. This is you're putting in all this effort to get funding for a training program 95, maybe 100% of the students that are supported by this training program are not going to be in your laboratory. So it's really people that are dedicated to enhancing graduate training, but it is a sacrifice, right? Because they're putting a lot of time into this. So we think about how can we incentivize this? How can we support our PIs that take this on? And that can be things like teaching relief or providing some discretionary funds that offset the time that they are required to put in to make this grant successful. Another piece of this is institutional financial support. So when one of these training grants is successful, it actually doesn't 100% fully support the students that are part of the training program. So NIH pays a stipend. The NIH stipend rate now, I think, is $27,000 a year. So when NIH gives Cornell, okay, you can have six students on this training program, we're gonna give you $27,000 each. You know that that's not our stipend level here. So we're responsible then for bringing that and making it whole. Same with tuition, NIH pays 60% of the Cornell tuition. That leaves this 40% of tuition costs remaining. And then these programs, you know, it's an extra layer beyond our normal training programs, and there can be expenses associated with that. Hosting a symposium, having the students typically get training related expenses. So there are costs related to running these, and having a clear and well-defined mechanism that's equitable for how we provide support for these is something we need to move toward. And then the final piece is institutional administrative support. We provide some of this support currently, but this relates to those massive data tables I mentioned, getting all the data in a straightforward way that one can use to support these. There's some language in the grants that is repeated, like facilities and equipment that's available at the institution that can have 10 different training grants at an institution. They'll use the kind of same language for this instead of each PI reinventing the wheel, providing more support for that institutionally. Program assessment is another one that is really critical for each program and something NIH looks at closely and is something we can support. And I think this all would benefit from some centralized program manager or staff that could help us be successful with these. So, and that's a big picture overview. I'd say, you know, my current role, I guess if I was gonna boil down to the three things, one is kind of reviewing life sciences structure, two is training grants and helping to improve training grant support at the university, and three is just kind of being another contributor at the graduate school, being at the table, thinking about challenging situations, thinking about day-to-day operations of the graduate school and trying to contribute to that the best. So that's kind of the whirlwind tour. I'd be glad to answer any questions about this or other things you might have on your minds.
Thank you so much. I was curious to your first point of your new job role, kind of understanding all of the life sciences department. Do you have plans for engaging with graduate students in those departments as well as the like current faculty administration?
Yeah, absolutely. I think for this to work, right, it's faculty level engagement, it's staff, GFAs and other staff that support these programs and students. And I think for whatever changes we make, we need to have everybody on board and everybody, we need input from everyone. So kind of starting with a small group and DGSs in particular, and then as we kind of get on, that group gets on the same page, kind of expanding out to bring in more and more people and get more and more input. That'll be really important.
Well, GPSA is happy to help however we can with student engagement.
Terrific, I appreciate it.
Are there any other questions for Professor Weiss?
I would love to hear about how you think the humanities can get more involved, because this was very bio. Biocentric.
Yeah, so my background and my focus in the short term is in the life sciences. I think some of the things that we'll work on are broadly applicable and can be applied. I think a great example is Careers Beyond Academia. That actually started as an NIH-funded program, BEST, Broadening Experiences in Scientific Training, but the themes are applicable across fields. So I think that's a great model for how something could start in the sciences and then spread university-wide. And I think aspects of, governance of graduate field structures, I think there's relevance across programs. I think the training grant aspect is a little, well, NI training that's going to be unique to biomedically oriented fields. There might be aspects of, you know, humanities, social sciences that intersects a little bit with NIH. So there might be necessary to think about some of the other maybe funding avenues on the list, philanthropy and other things that would be accessible for all fields at the university.
Yeah, I really like the idea of seeing where our grads go and then potentially positioning them for increased funds. I think that's a really good idea.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, I've had some of those starting discussions, and it's, you know, I think there are challenges because you go to biotech and they benefit now from the great training we provide without paying for it. So, you know, how can I convince them to start contributing? But I think you can make an argument, one, for the system to be sustainable. We need that kind of support. And I think there are connections that you know, pharma would benefit from early on to have linkages to a place like Cornell and access to Cornell students and connections. And it actually benefits both ways, because, you know, then you have opportunities for Cornell students to, say, do an internship at a company and have better job prospects down the road. So I think there's some good opportunities.
Awesome. Thank you so much, and good luck in your new role. All right, we will now move on to introducing the business of the day. We have two topics of conversation, one of which is Resolution 7, which I believe we have talked about before, but it is adding on a permanent representative from the GPSA to the Ad Hoc Committee on Cornell University's Corporate Social Responsibility ESG's Policy. That was created by the undergrad student assembly. So it's just us nominating someone each year to be on that committee that the undergrad essay started. So we will talk about that and vote on that today. And then we also needed to make updates to Appendix B of our charter due to the changes that we made in the clubs that are able to get exempted from different, like, the funding tiers. Like, we need to add that into our charter, which requires a big vote. We have to let everyone know about that a meeting before we vote on it. So we don't actually have a written resolution yet, but David, if you maybe have kind of the big takeaways of what that'll look like.
I'm going to send it actually in just in a second.
Okay, send it to...
Can you send it in the Zoom chat?
Sure, I can do that, yeah.
Okay.
And then Jessica.
Yeah.
Should we slowly break out?
Lillian.
Yeah.
Can I say something?
Yes, please.
To add to David's? So this is something that's outlined in the charter, is that after a D setting, after the graduate and professional student activity fee is set in the spring semester after that, Appendix B is supposed to be rewritten. It was not done 2 years ago, so I've really been pushing David to get this ready for you all, because we really need to get it updated to date. A lot of, I don't know what David's added, but a lot of things are, dates and offices are really out of, they're 4 years old, and it really needs to be redone. And then I'm sure he's added a few things, as you said, but just to give some more context to it.
Yeah. So we won't be voting on that today, but David's going to share that, and we just need to have everyone kind of take a look at that, because we are going to be voting on it at our last meeting of the semester and hopefully passing it, so that we can update that for next year with all that important information.
After David sends it in the chat, I can send it out through the JPSA email. So yeah, that way everyone has it.
We'll have, yeah, it'll be a solid version of it that you can refer back to. And if you have any questions or issues about it, please, like, email us in the interim. Don't wait until the next meeting. If it's something that you would, like, bring up as an issue, please let, you know, David or the executive board know, so that we can make those changes, so that we can hopefully pass it relatively smoothly at our final meeting of the semester.
And also GPSA at cornell.edu. or GPSA-exec at cornell.edu. Either it will make its way to us.
Yeah. Is it worth doing a breakout session?
I think so we've already talked about resolution 7. I don't think we have to.
All right.
Unless people really want to. A straw poll. Raise your hand if you really burningly want a breakout room.
All right, great. We'll keep it open. That'll save us 5 to 10 minutes. So all right. So we will now move on to discussing resolution 7, the joint committee, etc. Would anyone like to make any comments? If there are no issues with it, I would entertain a motion to call the question.
So moved.
Do we have a second?
Second.
All right, we will now move on to a vote. If you approve this resolution, please raise your placard.
Green check marks on Zoom means approve. Red X's means now on Zoom. And if you're impartial, pick a third emoji.
All right, you can put yours down if you're in the room. All right, I see, 20.
Well, I don't think
this. Okay. All right, I see 20. Do we have anyone who votes no for this resolution?
To vote no on Zoom, do a red X.
And is there anyone who would like to abstain from this resolution? All right. We might have lost some people on Zoom, but I believe it has passed 20-0. Congrats, everyone. Yeah, I can. All right. With that, I don't know if David sent it in the chat yet or not, but we can start with the reports until we get that. So, executive committee.
Please nominate yourselves if you are interested in running for a voting member, committee chair, or executive board position. I believe that there's still no nominations for VP of operations.
Or any of the committee chairs.
So we would really love to have you all. And if anyone wants to talk about what those types of positions entail, I've done some of them, Malia's done some of them. And I'm sure we would all be willing to talk to you about them.
They close
tonight. So really essential that you get those in. And for roles that are not filled, like many of you joined through informal voting, once the semester is started, that will also happen.
The voting will start on Wednesday and will go for 1 week. So please encourage all of the people in your departments, all of your friends to actually vote because then they can just have a voice and part of the process and see who's representing them.
The only other thing that I have to really update is that tomorrow is a university assembly meeting where they will be passing a response to the interim expressive activity policy. And then also, what was it? It was another related motion talking about the way the communication of the policy and the implementation of the policy and how the university assembly felt on that. If anyone wants access to those documents, just let me know and I can share them.
All right. Operations, Annika is not here.
Nick?
Sure. We're actually planning a meeting for just after this meeting today to go over a first round of edits for all the relevant sections of the Constitution bylaws. So we're hoping to kind of close in on something to actually start discussion starting next semester.
Amazing. That's been a big project. I'm excited to see how it goes. Appropriations, David.
Not much.
Okay. Working on that update to Appendix B. Communications.
Please nominate. yeah, it's a pretty quick process. There's like a candidate statement, but it's 1,200 characters, not words. So it's not that bad.
Maximum as well.
Yeah. We just need to say my name, the department you're in, and kind of why you're interested in it. It's not that deep. Yeah, and just put a picture so we can put a name to the face. But if you're even remotely interested, just put your name in the hat and see what happens. That's definitely what I did last year, and it's been a really great experience serving on an executive board. So I really encourage any of you that are interested to apply.
Great. Finance.
Also not much.
Student advocacy. DISC.
I don't see the DISC rep here. I know DISC is planning on doing an end of year celebration for all the things that they've done. I think that they collaborated with, oh God, I'm going to butcher this. It's the food organization, Spanish No Tears. It's the translation, if anyone.
No more tears.
Yeah, no more tears. Yeah, they have a lot of updates in the communique, and I think that's probably the best place to see what they've been up to this year.
Programming. Katie, are you here?
Hi guys. So the gala is this weekend. We're super excited. It's gonna be at the Statler from 8 to 12. If you guys haven't seen the information about it, everything's mostly set. I just have a couple of volunteer spots that are open still. So if there's anybody that like didn't get a ticket that wants a ticket, or if you know anybody, like if you have any friends that like need to get one, I have like, I think 5 left. So you can just have them email me. But other than that, that's pretty much it on my end. So
awesome. All the 500 tickets sold out, Katie.
Oh yeah. Yeah. There was like some issues with Cornell ticketing. I don't exactly know what happened, but they are all sold out. So
Katie, I'm also getting some questions about the theme. Could you officially state what the gala theme is?
Yeah, it's a masquerade ball.
Perfect. Yeah.
So it's more like Bridgerton vibes and like Phantom of the Opera. But we will have masks for everybody when they get to the door. So like if people don't have actual masks, then that's fine. And they're also gonna get like raffle tickets. We're having prizes and stuff. Yeah, and then I'll send the link for the volunteer sheet in the group chat if anybody wants to, like, sign up for it or anything.
Thank you, Katie. Graduate schools.
3 quick things all related to our programming in the student life area. One is this semester we've been piloting a program with a faculty member who has made herself available for counseling with students, especially when they run into a challenge with their advisor and so forth. And we will be collecting data on the efficacy of that program, and the hope is to expand it, actually, as we look to the future. But we think this semester has been a success in that particular space. It's been pretty limited so far, thinking of making
it. Like expanding the ombuds range a little bit?
But more specific to graduate students, okay. And very specific to dealing with the kinds of issues that graduate students run into with regard to their advisors specifically, and academic performance. So that's number one. Number two, also related to student life, is we are partway through the process of bringing on a new person in the student life office. We had well more than 50 applications for the position. It's now narrowed down to 10. We're starting our screening, and we're hoping to be moving on to narrowing it down to 2 or 3 within the next week or so. So stay tuned for that. That's a really exciting thing. Number 3, very small
come to happy hour this Friday. I'll be there. I really do enjoy speaking to grad students in an informal setting. So to Jaya, Friday, Big Red Barn. Not the same night as the gala, is it?
No, gala's on Saturday.
Good. Okay. come to Big Red Barn on Friday.
Awesome. Thank you so much. It looks like we got David's update. So I don't know if people want to pull that up on phone or if we can pull it up on the big screen, Jessica, just so we can quickly look over that and see if there are any major concerns before we adjourn.
I wish I had said this one. It is 6 pages. It's the whole thing.
So maybe a recommendation that you all go home and look at this. Because we can't vote on it today anyways.
Yeah.
Within the 6-page thing, where is the change?
So the whole thing has to be updated. So this would be the new Appendix B. And the old Appendix B would be
null and void. Okay.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe we could do a track changes. Difficult, yeah, to maybe do a track changes or a red line document just so it's easy for us to see the changes. But it's mostly, does this new one represent what we are currently doing? So, yeah, it might be easier for if we could ask the voting members to give this a glance over or a solid read before the next meeting.
And if anyone didn't get this, let me know and I will send it to you personally.
David, do you have maybe some of like the major takeaways from this, just so that we know what we're gonna be looking at as we read this on our own?
Yeah, so not too much has changed. A lot of it taking out bylines that don't exist anymore. Changes to just like the language overall. Not law formatting. I think in the grand scheme of things, it's not too different. There was a lot of like excess that I cut because it just wasn't relevant anymore. So I think the previous one was 10 pages.
All right, well, our current appendices are on the website. So if anyone is interested and wants to kind of compare, you now have that option. Unless there's anything else, I think we can move to the open forum. Is there anything anyone would like to discuss?
Yes. So I received on Friday's email about the referendum, and I was not super sure what's this about. Would somebody care to elaborate a little bit, explain like what's the role of Chief BSA in there, and what does it legally mean if people are voting for something about like the divestment? Yes, I'm sorry. How does it relate to this ad hoc committee that we're appointing members to?
So the Undergraduate Student Assembly had their vote, their ballot for their like incoming SA members, like we are about to have. They also included 2 referendum votes on that ballot. So it was really only for undergraduate students that this vote was. So graduate and freshman students were not eligible or involved in this vote, potentially beyond supporting, you know, tabling or something like that. But we were not voting on this. Mm-hmm. There were 2 different questions. One was about if students wanted Cornell to support the ceasefire in Gaza, and perspectives on both sides were shared in the language of the vote. And then the second question was on if students wanted Cornell to divest from a list of, I think, 6 or 10 companies that do support or manufacture weapons that are being used in the war in Gaza. So GPSA has not been involved at
an administrative or organizational or leadership level of that. I don't believe that we've ever had, or in my knowledge, that I don't believe GPSA has ever had a referendum vote along with our GPSA vote. Last year, I think we had under 10% of people vote in our voting. I don't know if having a referendum would increase that, but the ad hoc committee is separate from the referendum. I don't believe there's anything legally binding at all about these referendums. It's more just showing Cornell administration what the student populace is feeling with numbers to back it up. So those results have been sent to President Pollack. They were 70-30 for both questions, or yes, by the way.
Yeah.
Thank you, though.
So how would we resolve it here in the case of we would need to like send somebody to this committee and like give our answer to this, like some kind of more political or questions that are more divisive? So should we, I would say, think about a vote maybe in future, or what are our options?
So we have now formally, through the passing of that resolution, decided that we will put someone to that committee formally from GPSA, so the Committee on Divestment broadly. This isn't pertaining particularly to this situation currently. And that committee, my guess is likely will put forward resolutions either suggesting or not suggesting on issues of divestment more broadly, including probably because this is at the forefront of so many people's minds right now, divestment from these 10 weapons dealers. So that would have to be done probably through a resolution, which goes to Martha. All of our resolutions, if not otherwise stated, go to Martha, and she has to respond to those. And then specifically on issues of divestment, we have our student trustee here, which is really awesome, but all of the assemblies, so this includes faculty, staff, undergraduate, graduate, and university assembly, if all five assemblies send a divestment resolution and it is approved through all those assemblies, then the trustees have to respond. And the trustees are the ones who control that, obviously. So that would be the process. Are there more questions?
That's it, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, another question is like, do we know in what else Cornell has invested in? Not really, right?
Gus, can you speak more to this? But I don't think the investment portfolios are apparent to us.
Yeah, we're the divestment committee, or I guess the ESG CSR committee, is in the process of trying to get access to that information. And it's probably gonna take a second. So yeah, requesting information about what we're actually invested in, and then using that to cross-reference with the divestment guidelines that the university set out in 2016, which says basically don't invest in bad stuff, and then showing where those don't match up and like putting forward a report basically that says it, that like backs up the referendum. I don't know, with some people love reports, basically official. So
yeah. Maybe another just point of clarification is even if all the assemblies pass a motion, the trustees can still come back and say no. Mm-hmm. So that is maybe just something I like to think of in the same way that there was the OBGYN gynecology resolution last year. I don't know if you guys have heard of this, but it was essentially suggesting that Cornell Health hire an MD gynecologist. I believe all the assemblies passed it and it was still voted down, and we do not have an MD gynecologist. So in the same way that, you know, we can all request something, the university can also come back to us and say no.
All right, are there any other issues that would have to be brought up during the open forum? I would look for a motion to adjourn.
Sound.
All right. Good meeting, everybody. Please vote and submit your nominations tonight. And we'll see you in 2 weeks once we know who the next members and executive board are.
If you want to talk more with graduate.